A Star is Born by Richard Dinick. The vast spaceship was adrift, its hull listed drunkenly on one side, seemingly out of kilter with the planet far below. Yet the craft was still moving, dragged through the lower reaches of the exosphere by gravitational pull. Towards the rear of the octagonal ship was its communications array, a vast mass of aerial dishes and spherical radar pods. All of them were broadcasting, and all of them were broadcasting the same simple plea. Help. It was this message that attracted the TARDIS to the ship. Egrabil was on his way to the Provost's cabin when he heard the strange sound fading in the distance. He made off down a side passage and emerged into a cross-sectional walkway. There he froze, his lower nostrils closed in surprise. Not only was there a clearly foreign object nestled into one of the alcoves, there were also four very odd aliens standing before it. They had what looked like whiskers on the top of their heads, while their flesh tones were all pale, an unnatural mixture of pink, white, and yellow. Two were clearly male, and the third female. The fourth appeared to be a juvenile, and Egrabil could not discern its gender. It had been a long time since they had been visited by strangers, and he tried to steady his nerves.
"I acknowledge you,"
he said, intoning the traditional greeting.
"And we acknowledge you,"
said the one with the white whiskers, giving a slight bow.
"I am the Doctor. This is my granddaughter, Susan, Miss Barbara Wright, and Mr. Ian Chesterton."
Egrabil blinked his large, dark eyes in friendly understanding.
"We've come to help,"
said the female.
"Grandfather says you're in trouble,"
said the juvenile.
"You received the message?"
Egrabil's whiskers bristled at excitement.
"Please, come with me,"
he said.
"You must meet Rhode."
Wanderers in the fourth dimension. That is how the Doctor had described himself and Susan when Barbara had first met the old man. Now the two teachers were wanderers also. Though it seemed to Barbara that wandering through history was only half the story. And as far as the Doctor's travels went, wandering seemed a little too passive a description to be truly accurate. Now she was marvelling at the potted history of an alien race, the Matraxes, and learning how a certain number of them came to be on this falling ship so far from home. She examined their host. Egrabil had a perfectly black skin that looked slick, as if covered in oil. His head had no hair, but a set of magnificent silvery whiskers protruded from his cheeks and above his large, glistening eyes. He also seemed to be carrying a great deal of excess fat, as his stomach was a pronounced pot belly. Egrabil described their world. A beautiful, aquatic planet called Kinneret. Given the Matraxes' similarity to sea lions, such a place had suited them well. But the race had become sterile through a debilitating viral disease. It had spread steadily through the populace, changing and mutating, making it difficult to create a vaccine, let alone a cure. In order to procreate, they relied on a type of cellular biogenesis to create new members. But each progressive cloning resulted in the loss of some key genetic information and a shortening of the Matraxes' lifespan. Some Matraxes believed that their seemingly benevolent planet was to blame, and had decided to leave Kinneret in search of somewhere new. That had been 7 generations ago. Barbara nodded sadly as she listened. The race had done nothing wrong, and yet history, or nature, or something, had selected this as their fate. She frowned at the injustice. The provost proved to be a much older Matraxes, reclining on what looked like a chaise longue in a circular control room that doubled as his personal quarters. He rose, eyes wide and several nostrils flaring.
"I acknowledge you all,"
he said with a throaty growl.
"I am Rhode."
Egribil quickly explained the arrival of the TARDIS and that the Doctor and his friends were here to help.
"A generous offer,"
barked Rhode, as he operated some controls on one of the bulkheads. A sky-blue schematic was projected into mid-air, fizzing slightly. A vast chamber at the rear of the ship was depicted in white.
"This is the engine deck,"
he explained.
"Our propulsion generators have failed. Radiation is leaking from the fission reactors at an alarming rate. Our young crew does what it can, but they lack knowledge, and there is no substitute for experience."
Rhode slumped back into the long couch, as if his speech had exhausted him.
"I couldn't agree more,"
the Doctor said.
"I am well versed in a number of propulsion systems, and Chesterton here is a scientist of a sort. Aren't you, my boy?"
Ian smiled.
"Yes,"
he said.
"I am a science teacher."
"This is a fortuitous happenstance indeed,"
breathed Rhode.
"The ship has now been captured by this planet's gravitational pull. If we cannot repair the drive system, we will burn up in the atmosphere."
"And if you cannot plug that leak, your people will die of radiation poisoning."
The Doctor thrust his chin up and peered at Ian. "We cannot let that happen, hmm?" Ian recalled the dreadful sensation that accompanied radiation sickness all too clearly.
"No,"
he said.
"Take them to Greneva,"
Rhode said wheezily.
"She is young, but as expert as any in the engineering section."
The Doctor and his companions found the vast reactors of the engine deck several levels down, manned by a skeleton crew, headed by their chief engineer, Greneva. Much like the other Matraxes, the young female found that physical effort tired her easily. The Doctor had been very understanding. Without hesitation, he had taken off his long frock coat, rolled up his sleeves, and started a manual examination of the power rods that drove the ship's reactors. The process was easy, with Greneva releasing the locking mechanism, and the Doctor then removing the rods one at a time by turning a heavy copper wheel. Even though her part was not strenuous, Greneva often winced in pain, once actually crying out. But after several grueling hours, all the checks were complete. The Doctor was sitting on a sturdy pipe in the operation room, wiping his brow with a handkerchief.
"There is simply no explanation,"
he said, shaking his head.
"All systems should be functioning perfectly. There is no leak from the engines."
"There must be," Ian replied.
"We must have made a mistake."
"Mistake?" the Doctor said angrily.
"We made a meticulous examination of the reactor. There is no malfunction. What are we to conclude from that,
I don't know, said Ian eventually.
Well, I think we should investigate.
The doctor stood up and tapped at a computer terminal set in the nearby turbine housing.
Look here.
Ian looked. The screen displayed a top-down map of the engine section.
If the leak is not in the reactor, it must be in the vents,
the doctor explained.
I want to make a more thorough examination.
Greneva took Ian and the doctor to the room where the engineers kept their safety equipment, and they donned radiation suits. They were a little baggy around the middle and slightly tight on the limbs if you weren't a Matraxes. But these drawbacks were compensated for by the comparatively long boots and gloves. Armed with torches and what Ian assumed was a Geiger counter, they clambered through a narrow access hatch and pulled the heavy metal door closed behind them. Even with the emergency lighting, it was dark and cramped in the narrow duct. Pipes of various sizes ran along its length and covered the height of the bulkheads. Ian rested his hand on one of the conduits and quickly snatched it away again. It was searing hot.
Don't touch anything,
the doctor called, his voice muffled by the mask. After several minutes, they reached a junction. Greneva explained that this was where the vent network actually began.
It all works on a series of overflow pipes,
Greneva explained.
Normally, the waste material or contaminated steam is carried by the primary exhaust mechanism.
She pointed at a fat metallic tube that ran at waist height and was denoted by a series of orange decals.
Any excess is redirected to the secondary system here.
She indicated the space above her head, and they set to work tracking the two pipes down the ducts, sometimes having to take diversions down tiny shafts akin to potholes. When the doctor's team returned to the main engineering deck, they found Egrabil relating more of the Matraxes' history to Barbara and Susan.
The idea of the race being saved by a ship escaping some cataclysm is a key story in our Bible,
Barbara said.
The book of our religion.
One book of one religion,
Susan corrected.
They have quite a few religions on Earth.
Greneva removed her radiation suit and helped the doctor with his. If he had been tired before, the old man now was exhausted. He was breathing heavily. But there was a look of glowering rage on his face. Barbara dare not ask what the matter was.
We used to have religion, to have faith,
Egrabil was saying. He looked up.
I think there is only so much a people can take before the idea of a supreme being loses its attraction.
He smiled.
But it is certainly interesting that there exists a similar story to ours in your folklore. Did they too suffer from years of radiation leaks?
Susan laughed.
It was a wooden ship.
The doctor looked up sharply.
Did you say years, Egrabil?
He asked.
Yes,
said the Matraxes.
The reactors have been leaking since before I was crafted. I think only Rode can recall a time when they functioned perfectly. There are precious few of his age these days. But come to think of it, there are precious few of any age. I think our ranks must number a mere few dozen.
Without a further word, the doctor left the room with Ian at his heels. Barbara touched Greneva's arm.
What's the matter?
She asked. Greneva looked after them with her big eyes, and Barbara could see they were wet with tears.
Sabotage,
she said. The
Doctor was striding down the corridor with the vigor of a man half his age. Ian was keeping up, but only just. Greneva was following on with Barbara, Susan, and Egrebil. Finally, the forced march stopped. They were once more outside the Provost's quarters.
Grandfather, what are we doing?
Asked Susan, catching her breath.
Seeking the truth, my child,
the Doctor replied, hammering on the copper door. It slid open to reveal Roe lying on the chaise lawn.
You, sir, are the worst kind of scoundrel,
the Doctor said, clutching both his lapels and regarding the Matraxi's leader with a haughty stare.
A traitor to your own race.
Barbara was aghast. Doctor, are you sure?
I am certain,
said the Doctor, not taking his eyes off Road.
This man has betrayed the people. He has been poisoning them slowly for years. What I cannot fathom is why.
Suddenly, Road deflated. He began to weep. A strange sound from Atraxes. It was a half sob, half bark.
What is happening here?
Asked Egrebil.
How dare you accuse our provost of such a heinous crime?
I dare, sir, because it is the truth. Ask him yourself.
Egrebil regarded his leader. Rhodes' shoulders were heaving with sobs.
The radiation was being recirculated from secondary venting into the main life support system,
Greneva said. She sounded broken. Barbara shook her head.
I thought your people were blameless, she whispered. I thought you had suffered so much for no reason. You were civilized. You welcomed strangers instead of fearing them.
Is it true, Rhode?
Asked Egrebil.
Only he could have done it,
Ian said.
No one else has control of the ship's systems. The life support readings would have told the Provost that something was wrong,
the Doctor added.
And unless it was he who had performed the sabotage in the first place, he would have done something about it.
Why?
Egrebil's incredulity was beginning to break along with his voice.
I gave up,
the Provost said.
I gave up so long ago.
He shook his head.
Provost Road, custodian of the Matraxi, always guiding, always hoping. But I knew that the search was hopeless. I had to take action. Alone, no one else could shoulder the responsibility. The radiation seemed the best way.
His voice rose angrily.
We had left our planet behind us for nothing. It was not for nothing,
Egrebil said.
Our search for a new home, one that did not poison us, is paramount. How can that be nothing?
Rhode laughed humorlessly.
The irony is that we have found one.
Everyone stared at the Provost.
All the readings indicated that this planet was ideal.
Rhode almost spat the last word out as he jabbed a finger at the view screen.
But then the engines failed,
the Doctor said.
Your tampering had finally eroded the proper venting system. It didn't matter to you because your slow-burn murder plans were almost complete.
Don't you see?
Pleaded Rhode.
It was all too late. I couldn't undo 20 years of radiation poisoning. There was no hope that we would be able to survive for long on the planet in our weakened state.
Hope,
said the Doctor,
is what many cling to, believing it to be a last resort. In fact, it is one of the most enduring emotions.
You cannot understand what it is like to be exiled from your own planet,
said Rode.
To wander the stars, seeking a place, not just to call home, but to actually be one.
I think we can, Susan said quietly.
You!
Greniva hissed, baring her teeth at the provost.
You have killed us all.
Rode looked up, a faraway look on his face.
I had to kill us all before we reached the planet. The ship would burn up on entry. It would be quicker, kinder.
You're insane, Ian said.
You killed us all!
Greniva screamed again, doubling up in agony.
You see the effects of your poison?
Egrebel shouted, bending down beside the female Matraxes.
I have saved her from a lifetime of false hopes. I have released her from the misery of this ship-bound prison existence.
Rode's sobs were replaced by defiance.
I believe you may have done more than you knew,
the doctor said. He stooped to examine Greniva, and Ian saw the merest suggestion of a smile at the old man's mouth.
Indeed, I think you have achieved the opposite of what you had intended.
His hand was pressing gently on Greniva's stomach.
This young woman is with child,
he pronounced, smiling at the mother-to-be. Greniva looked at him in disbelief.
It cannot be,
she said.
We are barren as a species.
You are pregnant,
said the doctor,
and probably in labor. But the ship, grandfather,
Susan wailed.
It's adrift, powerless, it's going to burn up.
Yes, 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 child, the doctor tutted. We can use the TARDIS. And that is what they did. Rode was arrested. Egrebel took charge of the evacuation, and all the crew members were transported to the surface below by the doctor. Escape pods were sent down to the planet, crammed with as much technology and ration, information and learning as the Matraxes could manage to load. The TARDIS had materialized on a beautiful stretch of coast overlooking the Lavender Ocean. As the Matraxes survivors gathered on the sand, they looked up at the sky to see a blazing streak moving slowly overhead. This, too, was the doctor's handiwork. He had managed to put the ship into a slow descent, meaning that it would burn up harmlessly over the course of many months. Now it was a symbol of hope for the future. Last to exit the timeship was Greniva. She was carrying the swaddled form of her baby son. He was whimpering quietly and nuzzling his mother, demanding more milk.
Thank you, Doctor,
she said.
Thank you all. We owe you everything.
Nonsense, my dear,
the doctor smiled.
We are glad to help. Now, you run along and look after that young pup, won't you?
He smiled as he watched her go.
Radiation must have altered her genetic code, mutated it back to being capable of conception.
Do you think she's the only one? Asked Ian.
I would find that most remarkable, wouldn't you?
The doctor looked sideways at the schoolteacher.
In fact, I think the Matraxes should start to become more accustomed to the sound of children